Hi, and welcome to the Overshoot Podcast,
a 9-part podcast series by the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, IASA.
My name is Frederik Hocke.
And I'm Francesca Grandolfo.
We are climate journalists and founders of Kurzschluss Redaktion based in Vienna.
In this podcast, we will interview 9 experts in different fields to understand how we can cope with a world post 1.5 degrees warming.
Each episode is a little sneak peek into the topics of the Overshoot Conference hosted by IASA in Luxembourg, end of September.
The Overshoot Conference will discuss in depth how we can navigate the risks, trade-offs, and opportunities that come with overshoot scenarios.
We are very excited to be able to talk to some of those experts in advance and hope you enjoy listening to our conversations.
Thanks for tuning in. Hi, and welcome back to the 3rd episode of the Overshoot Podcast. Today we're joined by Kevan Riahi, who is the Director of Energy at IASA. Thanks for joining us, Kevan.
Hello, hi.
Kevan has ample experience in interdisciplinary research of climate change response options, providing policy advice at the international as well as national level. He has been recognized as one of the most influential climate scientists and was also awarded the highly prestigious European Research Council Award for his research on carbon dioxide removal, today's topic. So, let's start with the basics, Kevan. What is carbon dioxide removal?
Yeah, carbon dioxide removal describes different options that we have in order to remove CO2, which is carbon dioxide, from the atmosphere. Why do we want to do that? We want to do that because through industrial processes, we emit CO2 emissions into the atmosphere, and we are getting closer and closer to the climate targets. And at the moment when we have overshot our climate targets, it becomes necessary to think about how to get the molecules from the atmosphere again back out of the atmosphere. And carbon dioxide removal are different options to do so.
So very quickly, Kevan, can you just explain to me also what the difference is between CDR, so carbon dioxide removal, and storage, carbon dioxide storage?
Yeah, sometimes a carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere is confused with a carbon capture and storage. Carbon capture and storage basically describes the process where you burn fossil fuels, and then instead of taking the CO2 and releasing it into the atmosphere, you basically capture that CO2 and put it underground. You can never do that with 100% efficiency. Carbon capture and storage, CCS, helps you to use fossil fuels at very low greenhouse gas emissions. That does not help you to remove overshoot, because for removing overshoot, it's not necessary to produce energy without emissions. It's necessary to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. And CDR is a method to remove CO2 out of the atmosphere. So basically, BECCS, bioenergy, and CCS is a method to produce energy at negative emissions. Fossil fuels cannot achieve that. So we should not mix carbon capture and sequestration with CDR. They have quite different functions and uses. And I have seen that happen in the past, where people were referring to CDR, but actually they meant CCS. And that should be avoided.
Thank you so much for that clarification. So CDR can come in many different shapes and forms. Can you elaborate a little bit on what kinds of CDR there are, and maybe also already sketch out relative strengths and weaknesses?
Yeah, so in principle, there are many different options for how to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, but they have very, very different other implications for the society. So there's a whole cluster of technological solutions to which we can take CO2 out of the atmosphere. The most common option that is discussed here is so-called bioenergy plus carbon capture and storage. What is happening here, basically, when biomass grows, it takes CO2 out of the atmosphere to photosynthesis. This is then stored in the plant itself. And then the plant can be burned, and can be burned to produce electricity. We can produce heat out of it. And then you can remove the CO2 from the flue gas of the burning process and take that CO2 and put it back underground. You have then a technology that produces energy, but at the same time, it removes CO2 out of the atmosphere because the plant had to grow. And this is, of course, a technology which has been proven to be feasible. So we know that bioenergy works. We know that CO2 can be taken out of the flue gas. Its main trade-off is, though, that bioenergy needs to be grown on land. And if you do that very large scale, you get competition with other users of land, and it can jeopardize food security, but it can reduce also biodiversity. So you have to be very careful. Where do you do BECCS, and how do you apply it so that it's sustainable and it doesn't have any social trade-offs? That's why many people think also about other technological options, and these are, at the one hand, direct air capture. So you can imagine this is a big factory, and this factory sucks the air. And then when it basically takes the air out of the atmosphere, it removes CO2 and releases the rest again back into the atmosphere. And the CO2 again is put in underground into existing formations and needs to be kept there for centuries and millennia to be effective. A third technological option is to take CO2 out of the atmosphere, but then not to put it underground, but use that CO2 to, for example, create materials. So the big question at the moment is how do we create plastics? How do we create certain types of materials for which we need carbon? And at the moment, you use fossil fuels for that. We could also take CO2 out of the atmosphere, make those materials, and keep the materials over the lifetime. And to that, we have actually also a double dividend. At the one hand, we reduce CO2 from the atmosphere. At the other hand, we create materials.
When you hear this, Fried and I will explain some terms that maybe not all listeners are familiar with.
Negative emission materials are materials that capture and store more carbon dioxide throughout the entire lifespan than they emit during production, use, and disposal. So they act as carbon sinks. Examples for negative emission materials are carbon negative concretes and cements, biomass, wood derived construction materials, biochar, and some form of bioplastics.
The disadvantage, of course, here is that this is at the moment associated with relatively high costs. And it's also something that we don't know whether we can scale up easily. So, but very active field of research, I would say very important field of research, because the dematerialization of society and carbon neutral material is something that we have to think very carefully. And most of the research has been focusing on energy, but this is now also a way to think about negative emissions materials. I think most importantly, if you think about CDR, they are not only technological options, they are also nature-based solutions. The most common and the most easiest way to take CO2 out of the atmosphere is to basically foster plant growth. So afforestation, planting a tree, means to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. So increasing the area that is covered by tree, or managing and restoring wetlands, are all means that you would take also at the same time CO2 out of the atmosphere. Obviously, there is a co-benefit because natural areas are rare. They are recreational areas at the same time, and they also help us with biodiversity. The major trade-off of this type of solutions is their permanence. So at the one hand, forest areas are increasingly affected by climate impacts. So we have wildfires, you hear them on the news, I think, all over the world. But we have also pests and diseases where the forest is affected because of climate change, and the forest becomes more vulnerable. So the irony is that while we need to take CO2 out of the atmosphere and we need more forest, with the increasing emissions, it will become more and more difficult to expand forest and use forest to reduce CO2 out of the atmosphere. So also there, an option where you would have thought there is no trade-offs, also there are trade-offs and risks involved. Other options that nature-based solutions that are discussed at the moment are, for example, biochar. That's actually a very interesting option. Take biomass, you produce char out of it, and you can use that biomass to enhance the soil quality, reduce fertilizer use, reduce water use. But at the same time, in agricultural production, you can also store CO2 in the soil. So basically, you increase the carbon content of the soil. So that's an interesting option, not only because it has so many co-benefits, it's also an interesting option because it's cheap and it's a low-tech option. So you can use the African farmer can use it as well as the European farmer. You don't need a factory like a direct air capture. We have a basically low-tech solution, small scale, that can be used by small farmers in the developing world. And thus, it gets already also quite some attention. So let me come to the last options that I wanted to mention. So there's also enhanced weathering. Enhanced weathering means that you take basalt or some other rock formation, and you grind it. And the basalt itself, when it comes in contact with the atmosphere, mineralizes CO2 and takes CO2 up. So this is a little bit, you can imagine this as dusting the agricultural areas of the planet. And then the dust takes up CO2 and then it remains on the ground. So another idea that is tested at the moment, you need to have the right climatic condition, and also depending on the rock type, you can get a higher or lower efficiencies, but another option, a planetary scale option that is available as well. So I mentioned technical options. I mentioned options on land. And the third one that I want to mention are ocean-based carbon dioxide removal possibilities. This is particularly increasing, for example, the ocean alkalinity, which means that you change the composition of the ocean in a way that it can take more CO2 up. It's an option that we know it works, but it comes also with some trade-offs. First of all, there can be ecological impacts, because obviously if you change the seawater chemistry, it will affect marine organisms at the local scale, and I think that's not very well understood. Then there are also technical and logistical challenges, because you need to bring it up into the ocean, so you have to mine it, grind it, transport it, disperse it, which is also relatively complex. And then you need to monitor and govern it. And that's perhaps the most difficult thing in the ocean, because you don't know exactly how much CO2 you have taken out of the atmosphere with the ocean option, because it's a very wide range and scale where this is happening. So I would say a quite controversial option, but it exists as well.
Yes, thank you for this very comprehensive overview. I've definitely learned some new things right now. Even as a climate journalist, I was not aware of all these different options. As a climate journalist, I think one of the most discussed topics outside of the scientific community, at least, is probably carbon storage. And one concern here is reversibility, so that carbon that is stored might eventually be released again. How serious is this risk, and how can it be managed?
Yeah, so the risk is there. So I think the most important part of a functioning CDR policy and govern mechanism would be to the verification and the monitoring that needs to be very explicitly in any law that would basically try to facilitate the uptake of this type of options. But the risks are very different. Yeah, so the risk of CO2 getting back into atmosphere of the natural solutions that I mentioned earlier are usually either the risk that that basically the plants that you have planted die because of diseases, fire, or other purposes. But there's also a political risk. Yeah, so very often think about the times in Brazil a few years ago where Bolsonaro was basically going back into the Amazon, and we saw it even from the satellites how big parts of the Amazon started to burn again. If you have a policy which is very successful and you basically build up a big forest cover, it's vulnerable to policy shifts which basically take the land back again. So that risk will be there, will be always there. There's, I would say, manageable risk in terms of the CO2 coming back if you go into geological formations. I'm not a geologist myself, but if you look into the literature, the risk that there is, of course, always a risk of leakage, but that risk is quite low if you select your formation with the right quality standards and criteria. What all have, of course, in common is, and that's what we are all worried about this option, is that you have to monitor for hundreds of years. Yeah, so that option only works if the CO2 stays there for hundreds to millennia. And so it's a major undertaking. Perhaps if you're once at zero emissions and you are back to a climate and a safe climate, then some leakage doesn't matter so much and you can manage it later on. But at the moment, the perception is pretty much that monitoring needs to be long term.
Yeah, very interesting insights. It reminds me a little bit of the discussions also around nuclear waste, which I guess face similar challenges with the longevity and also political stability in a way. And that also brings us to my next question, because political stability also depends on public acceptance. So what about public acceptance for these different solutions?
Yeah, this is a very important question. I think that's something that this option has in common with others. It will only be deployed if there is also public support for it. And there's been a quite major study in Nature recently, where I was also involved, which looked into public perception of different options across 30 different countries in the world, some European countries, but also the big players, US, China, India, and so on, and also developing countries in Africa. And what we found is actually that there is distinctly different public perception between nature-based solutions and the technical solutions. Generally, the nature-based solutions get really high acceptability in most of the wealthy and developed economies, like in many of the European countries. You get a lot of positive responses about afforestation and even about things like biochar and enhanced weathering. You get relatively skeptical responses and much lower public perception about the technical solutions like DACs. And we found out that this is particularly related to a perceived distrust to either the political elites or the business elites. So people in Europe and the population in wide parts of the US have lost the trust in their elites and therefore are more skeptical about these technical solutions. Interestingly, Africa, India situation looked very different. A lot of public support for technical solutions because it's also perceived to some extent that there will be support to apply those technical solutions in the countries, and they are seen as a business opportunity. So the public perception is actually quite different across different geographies.
Yeah, that's super interesting, the differences. In a way, it makes sense also the distrust, I think, in the Western world, because in the end, those are the countries that brought us to where we are today in terms of climate change. There's also one fear, I think, that if we focus on CDR, especially on the technical solutions, that this could distract from the urgent need to actually cut emissions. I think that's something we see in Austria as well, that there's a lot of focus on technical solutions rather than on preventing the problems. How do you think CDR should be balanced with other mitigation strategies?
Yeah, so I think this is a real risk that a big focus on carbon dioxide removal might lead to mitigation deterrence. So might lead to less removing the emissions at the first place from the societal activities. Yeah? So I think it's not an option to simply continue business as usual as we do it right now and scale up a whole industry that just takes at the same time CO2 out of the atmosphere. The sheer magnitude is just too big. We're emitting more than 40 gigatons of CO2 every year. We cannot take that 40 gigatons out of the atmosphere. So what we learn from those system studies is that 90% of the job needs to be to mitigation and 10% of the job needs to be through CDR. And we need to find a way that CDR is only used in combination with to offset emissions in sectors that are very difficult to abate and where we don't have alternatives at the moment. So there are economic sectors where we don't know how to get rid of the CO2 completely. And there it's important, if you want to achieve net zero emissions, which is necessary to stop climate, that we at least scale CDR up that much. So from my perspective, I think we need to start to create niche markets for CDR, CDR goals similar to mitigation goals, because we need very quickly. So we want to achieve net zero in 2050, which means we need to have significant CDR in 25 years from now. And technologies scale slowly and the forest is vulnerable. So I think actually our problem at the moment will not be the deterrence. Our problem will be, can we scale those technologies up as clearly as possible and then limit the application of those technologies to be substituted for mitigation. Yeah, so there needs to be some mechanism that says, okay, there needs to be just a fraction of the mitigation can be CDR, so that it doesn't it's not used as a compensatory mechanism with questionable permanence of some of the options.
Yeah, thank you very much for that answer. Super interesting. So you said that 10% of our efforts should be CDR and 90% should be mitigations. So how can we scale CDR responsibly to respect this division?
Yeah, so you need our own scale-up targets, for example, for CDR. And only over time, you would bring them into the mitigation space itself. Yeah. So ultimately, I think you want to have CDR as part of the portfolio, but you don't want to start right away from the beginning so that you don't deter the mitigation of the carbon-intensive industries. So you could, for example, say, okay, we are quite responsible for climate change as the European Union. We know that the net zero target alone will not be enough. We need for net zero already CDR, but we know that net zero will not be enough because we have already used our part of the atmosphere. We want to remove further CO2 from the atmosphere, and you have an own negative emissions target where different CDR options could facilitate the scale up of different CDR options into this separate market.
So just to quickly clarify, when we're talking about targets, really we're talking about policy and legal frameworks.
Right.
Okay.
That would be a legally binding target for the European Union to scale up negative emissions options and to create also the niche markets. Because if you want to have something in 20 years from now, you need to start now so that you can scale that option up.
Yeah, that almost brings us to the end. Looking ahead, what role do you see CDR playing in a world that is very likely to experience at least some degrees of overshoot?
Yeah, so I think the biggest role of CDR, we discussed it already, is to enable us, first of all, to achieve net zero emissions, to offset the residual emissions that are difficult to abate. In a world where we overshoot, and we are definitely on an overshoot pathway, CDR can help us at the global scale, first of all, of course, to draw down the temperatures again into this safe band. But CDR can also help us to do this in a more just and equitable way. So different countries will be differently responsible for the overshoot. So we know already now that if you think about the 1.5-degree target, which we just now are overshooting, that the major responsibility of that overshoot lies with the industrialized countries. So you could use also CDR as a justice mechanism and say, okay, those who are responsible, and this is attributable of that overshoot, they are also responsible of taking the CO2 again out of the atmosphere, bringing the climate back. And you can monitor that even in a dynamic way, where over time you can see those countries who emit more and more become more and more responsible, have more and more obligations to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. Those who are at net zero and perhaps even slightly below that will have lower obligations. And so you can design, I think, a more fair climate future through CDR as well.
Mm-hmm. Super interesting. So yeah, that brings us to the last question. What do you hope this conference session will contribute to advancing our collective understanding of CDR?
Yeah, I think the session can help us with various different things, many of which we discussed actually, how to facilitate the scale up of CDR, which are I think there are critical science questions that need to be addressed, and formally identifying the scientific agenda will be important for the conference itself. Also thinking about complementary mechanisms that need to fall into place to guarantee, on the one hand, sustainability of CDR options, but also equity and thinking about formal scientific methods that help us to basically derive to those solutions, because there are various ways to interpret who has to contribute how much to the reducing the overshoot, but science can help you do that systematically and in a I think less biased way. Yeah, I would stop here. So many, many things that session can contribute to.
Perfect, because we're at the end of this episode now also, but I learned so much in the last 25 minutes. So thank you so much for explaining everything and taking the time, Kevan.
Thank you, Francesca. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening to the third episode of the Overshoot podcast. If you haven't listened to our previous episodes yet, make sure to check them out and follow the Overshoot podcast to stay tuned for the next episodes coming out soon.